Sir Humphrey Burton is one of Britain's most influential post-war music and arts broadcasters. He's written a new book, In My Own Time, and I'm delighted to welcome Sir Humphrey to the show. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Nice to hear your voice.
Lovely to talk to you.
I still love you, sir, all that.
You were just telling me your daughter lives near us here.
Yes, she lives in Malmö. Well, she's been there for 2 or 3 months now, and the temperatures seem to me to be unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. A little better than the UK, I think, Humphrey.
Yeah, it's so drab and rainy here the whole time.
Oh, bless you. How have you got on with the last bizarre year and a half in the UK? How's it been for you?
Well, I've been very lucky, Bill, because I've been writing and then checking and proofreading and all the things to do with writing a book.
Yeah.
And writing a memoir of one's life. That's another word for autobiography. You've got to drain so far back down in your memory chains. I've done it, and I'm pretty proud of it. And anybody who's interested in broadcasting, I think will find it quite an interesting book.
Well, absolutely. I'm fascinated by it. I started in commercial radio back in 1975 on one of the first commercial stations in the UK. So my career goes back a fair way, but not as far as yours, it has to be said.
I regret to say I'm 90 now. I can hardly believe it.
Bless you.
Where did you work in commercial?
I was in Radio Victory, which is on the south coast. It's covered Portsmouth, Southampton and the Isle of Wight and Winchester. So it was one of the first kind of five commercial stations there. And I then moved to Radio Clyde in Glasgow, which was wonderful.
It was a bit colder.
It was my home territory, though, Radio Clyde, so I was happy with that. Us Scots don't mind the cold, you know. It's fine. It's absolutely fine. Your career, to say it's stellar, would be understating it somewhat.
No, don't overdo it. It would be overstated.
I'd love to talk to you about... Particularly, to start with, you were spearheading the BBC's preparation for the opening of BBC Two. That was launched in April 64.
Yeah.
Amazing to be there at the birth of something like that. What was the plan for the BBC for BBC Two? What was the kind of brief that was given for that?
Well, it was in the early 1960s, and the brief was to do something different.
Right.
Certainly, I was made a special, executive producer, special projects, something rather grandiose like that. But really, I had to go away and think up new ways of making programs which involve classical music.
Wow.
And that's really what my career has been all about, making music as lively as possible and encouraging people to enjoy it. I suppose the most popular thing I did was the Young Musician of the Year, which had brilliant youngsters, Britain's Got Talent sort of thing, but playing only classical music. And the spearheading of BBC Two was to find something new, dear boy, do something different. So I had a series called Workshop, which used symphony orchestras, but in order to, for example, we did a program about Paganini, the great violinist, and his Caprice, and how different composers had used it for inspiration for symphonic work. And so we had a symphony orchestra, and it was playing Rachmaninoff's Paganini variations and various other pieces, and we had very lively commentary. It was like documentary features masquerading as concerts.
And as you watch BBC Two now, have they strayed from their brief somewhat?
You ask the most sweet questions, Bill. Yes, they have slightly, haven't they? But they've gone where the audience is. BBC is, people pay the license money, they expect to get what they like. And my job was to put stuff onto them that they didn't think they knew, but they did like as they watched it. So I had a series that I mentioned called Workshop, another series called Masterclass, which had great teachers, because that's another very interesting subject, watching how people teach music, classical music. And classical music is such a huge reserve. It's such an enormous benefit to the whole continent of Europe. And it's the only place where you'll hear Spanish music as often on BBC Radio 3, probably as you will on Spanish.
Absolutely.
Radio.
And what a tragedy it is that, now in schools in the United Kingdom, children are just not being taught music in the way that they were.
I'm afraid that's true. I haven't been into it in detail, but all the accounts one reads suggest that it's being let slide, which is such a pity. The more children can make music, sing, and play instruments, the better it is.
Absolutely.
I was very lucky myself. I was co-opted into the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain.
Lovely.
Which was absolutely star turn, or should it only just? It had only just started when I was working when I was at my sixth form level, and my teacher got me in as an observer and a percussion player. So I played big bass drum and gong and cymbals and castanets and things in the greatest orchestra of young people that ever existed, and. I was so impressed by the quality of the players that a few years later, when I was in the BBC, I managed to create something called Young Musician of the Year, which is just to celebrate young musicians. And I think it's very, very important. Now, BBC Two, they were pioneer days, and I really enjoyed them. And I write about that quite a bit in my book. But I also, I started at the beginning, I started as a radio studio person who puts the mics out and does the balance, opens the pots and all things.
Wow.
And I wanted to do the music side of that, and I did for a year or two. But I also got tapped as a presenter. And I suppose if I'm known at all by the British public or by English-speaking people, it's as a presenter, whether it's a young musician or Omnibus or other. My most popular period was when I was working for ITV. I jumped ship and went to work for David Frost at ITV in a company called London Weekend.
Absolutely. Correct me if I'm wrong. Was London Weekend the one whose jingle went da 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 da? Was that theirs?
London Weekend.
Go on. Fantastic. That's the one. That's the one. And as somebody who's worked for the Beeb and for commercial TV, in the same way that I've worked for the Beeb in radio and also commercial, they're very different animals, aren't they? In some ways.
Well, I was astonished. I worked for Classic FM.
Oh, yes.
Quite a lot. And when I went to the Classic FM, I did a biography series, 20 episodes, each an hour long, about Leonard Bernstein, who's one of the great influences in my life. We'll talk about that later, I hope.
Yeah.
But when I went into the Classic FM studio, there wasn't a glass window between the between the producer and the contributor. He was just sitting opposite, talking to me.
Yeah.
And he was a lovely guy at Classic FM, and he said, "You're lecturing or pontificating. Just talk to me ordinarily." And he was just saying it across the path, just a meter away, and it turned me into a much better broadcaster.
Interesting.
The classic commercial radio, much more relaxed.
Yeah.
BBC, higher quality. I think one has to.
Yes. I was quite surprised when I first. I worked at BBC London in central London, and I was quite surprised coming from commercial radio. My first interview was from a guy. I did talk to someone who was in Los Angeles, and it was midday in the UK. Yeah. And they said, I'll wait till after six because the calls are cheaper then. So don't be ridiculous. It's the BBC, for goodness sake. That's my commercial radio background kicking in there.
I have a commercial radio background also. I work for Capital.
Fantastic. For absolutely. I know lots of Capital chums. Absolutely a lot. My ex-boss joined Capital, Richard Parkey, went to Capital, and he was the first guy who turned it into a split transmission between FM and AM. Yes. Capital Golds it was then. Yeah, absolutely.
I had an arts magazine called Alternatives. It was just a gossip column. Whoever was around at the weekend, I'd get to come and talk to me. Tom Stoppard
was quite
often there. Very classy people. And there's enough activity to make a very lively program. I was also doing at the same time an arts magazine for ITV. It's called Aquarius. So
yes.
I was very much the promoter of the arts on television.
That really was the kind of forerunner of the South Bank show, wasn't it, Aquarius?
Not only literally the forerunner, he took over the slot, he took over all the relationship between London Weekend and the other companies. They all had to take it because that was my program was mandatory, and the South Bank show. Melvin was a dear friend of mine, and I persuaded him, I wanted him to go and do it. He was in two minds about leaving the BBC to take over, but John Burt had asked him, and I said, do it, I want to keep that slot, it's worth it. And of course he did it triumphantly well.
Absolutely.
South Bank show without Melvin is still there.
Wonderful. You mentioned, of course, Bernstein there, and you had a long, long relationship and creative partnership with him. I'm fascinated by one of the stories in the book that you once knocked yourself out after walking into a plate glass window.
Yes. He had a will of iron. A whim, sorry, I've spoiled my own joke there. He had a whim of iron. And He'd arranged a contract between his company and mine where we would film everything that he conducted. So even if the third or fourth performances of something. And he said to me one day after a performance, he said, "Did you get that good today?" I said, "We weren't filming then." What? It was the greatest show that I've done. It was the same before, but I said, "Well, we've got a very good performance. We filmed on Tuesday." Fine, I won't have it. So he stormed off. And I, in my cups, because we were probably having a good Spanish drink afterwards or a good something drink anyway, I got up and said, "Well, that's a bloody well thing." And I swore worse than that. And I stormed off, and I stormed straight into a plate glass window and knocked myself absolutely silly.
Oh, dear.
I did knock myself silly. And then next day we'd made up, and we went swimming together in the harbour at Tel Aviv, which is a wonderful place for swimming.
Wonderful.
And we became friends again.
Wonderful.
But, I filmed, I think, over 150 different performances of his.
Goodness.
All the Mahler symphonies, all the Beethoven symphonies, lots of Brahms and Schumann and other things, and all his own music, which is marvellous. And we filmed performances of all those things. And filming music performances is my métier, I suppose.
Yes.
Could be filming opera, which is a lovely thing to do, but rather expensive. And filming concerts, whether it's the Promenade concerts in London's Albert Hall or straight concerts in Vienna, or I'd worked an enormous amount in Vienna with the Vienna Philharmonic and Bernstein.
Amazing.
And so if you want to see a good DVD of a Beethoven symphony, modesty makes me wonder, et cetera, but they're all there.
You directed the premiere of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Requiem.
Yes, I did. I liked working with Andrew Lloyd Webber.
I was fascinated to ask you whether, right then, you know, all those years ago, you spotted in him what was to come or not.
Well, I think everybody did. I mean, first of all, he was the most successful music man since George Gershwin, and his Requiem was that's the fruits of his own. Well, he did a trial run at his home in England, and I went to hear it, and I thought that's really promising. And then we did the performance of his Requiem in St. Thomas' Church on Fifth Avenue in New York. Very, very high-powered institution. And another choir came and joined him from England, joined them. So there was a big double choir, English style, plus Placido Domingo singing the tenor, and
wow.
Lauren Marzell conducting. It was a really star turn, but I haven't actually spoken to Andrew since that performance. I think he was rather upset because I did this sort of front-of-house announcements, which included, please turn off your telephones and your mobile phones.
Yes.
And in 1980-something, mobile phone was still a very new gadget, and people tittered when I made this request. I wasn't trying to make a joke or anything. The audience didn't like it, and I feel that Andrew felt I was somehow debasing the atmosphere, but it was a very grand occasion.
Wonderful.
Imagine having Placido Domingo doing your world premiere.
Amazing.
Of your movie, really.
Absolutely amazing. Some of the names that you talk about in your book are just kind of legendary names. Another one I must ask about is Russell Harty, whose career you kind of initiated, really.
Well, I did, in a way. You're quite right. I got a letter from him. He'd seen that I was going to do a new arts program, and he wanted to have lunch. So I took him out for supper, and after the meal, he pulled out an envelope from his pocket and said, "Don't read it now, but this is something I want you to know." And I thought, oh, he's making a job application, but it wasn't. He was saying that if you're looking for a front man, I can suggest my colleague, and I mentioned his name in my book, and he was just being helpful.
Wow.
And I liked him enormously. He was so funny. And I asked him to come and work on the program, which he did.
Goodness.
His first program was a commentary about circus, about the circus, which is just inside the remit of arts programs, I suppose. Anyway, he did a lovely show, and he interviewed the two halves of a horse, and the two blokes were quite good friends, but they didn't celebrated after they'd had the interview with Russell. They'd gone off to a pub, and they the result of which one of them got very full of wind, and he unfortunately was the back of the horse. When they went on to the And as Russell said, if I may permit it, a slight rudery, Russell said the collapse of this circus was a case of putting the fart before the horse.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant.
Not bad, was it?
Brilliant. You mentioned Sir David Frost and you had, of course, a great involvement with him. One of my big regrets in life was actually here in Spain. I bumped into this guy just apropos of nothing in a small village bar, and he said, I'm staying with David Frost. If you come back to the house, I'll introduce you. And I couldn't go. And so I was thinking, oh God, what have I done? Amazing. What a broadcaster. What a broadcaster.
Yes. I think Russell... Well, he was hounded to his death because of his personal life. His precipice wouldn't let him alone. Mm. If he'd just lived another 5 years or so, it would have all been quite different. Mm. But he just loved the human nature. I think he was quite a funny chap to be with.
Absolutely.
And I kept him on. Then when I went back to the BBC, Brian Wenham, the controller, bagged him and got him to come as well. And he did his Russell Harty Plus programme. It was lovely. I suppose of all the people I met, I would put Leonard Bernstein above Russell Harty, because Leonard was such a doer, such a great conductor, but at the same time he just loved mucking in with everybody, and I don't mean that he did the washing up, but he was a true friend and true colleague.
Brilliant.
He's very collegial, I think that's the right word.
Yes. In our digital age, we're very used to having, you know, tons and tons of music on our phones, on our PCs. Back in the day, and this is something I noticed has irritated you, and it really irritated me, the extraordinarily cavalier, almost, treatment of vintage programmes, particularly by the BBC, who wiped classic programmes for no particular reason.
Well, the reason we're given was the economy, that tape was enormously, videotape was enormously expensive, and we couldn't afford to fork out all that much and then just say goodbye to it. So we had to reuse the tapes, because they were perfectly used, as long as you didn't cut them.
Goodness me.
Cutting a tape was such a huge adventure in those days.
Oh, yes.
The biggest program I ever made was called The Golden Ring.
Right.
And it was about the Decca Record Company making a big recording of Wagner's Ring Cycle in Vienna.
Yeah.
And we did a co-production with the Austrian TV, which meant that they brought their cameras into the Decca studio. Quite a gamble, but it worked. And the only problem was that you couldn't edit it. You couldn't cut it. You couldn't cut the tapes. Took us hours, days, weeks, wading through all we'd recorded, making notes. But then you had to run all the stuff up in the studio in two different machines and plan, instead of cutting, I had to make jump cuts and what you know about mixing.
Yeah.
Some of your listeners will know about playing with tapes.
Absolutely.
We played with tapes in a very big way, but luckily it won all sorts of prizes, so it didn't do us any harm.
One of the most focused things you will ever do in your life, and I've had to do it many times, is to take a razor blade to a multi-track tape recording, a two-inch tape, and cut it. Yeah. And then try and stick it back together.
I wouldn't dare do that. It's such a detailed business.
Absolutely.
I think that probably I wasn't as close to the public as you are doing your radio program, but I do think that London Weekend managed to catch the right tone.
We didn't
condescend. We didn't talk down.
Yeah.
My program Aquarius was very successful. Got 2 or 3 million audiences every time it went out. And it covered such different things as the work of historical research and restoration in Venice, restoring all the marvellous artwork that had been done. There's a company called, an English organisation called Venice in Peril.
Mm.
And I made a film about them, but I built it around the day when they have the great gondola race going up and down the Grand Canal. So I was able to intercut between the gondola racing and the paintings by Canaletto of those gondola races. Valdi's amazing, wonderfully. And at the same time, getting a bit in about the excellent scientific work that the reconstructors were doing, blowing all the bird shit off the the marble statues.
Brilliant, brilliant. What's lovely is that you've been there and done it. Actually, the glory years, when I started quite young as a broadcaster, I was lucky enough to win an Ivor Novello Award as a songwriter, you know, back in the day when people actually sold records. To be the BBC's head of music and the arts, which you were back in the kind of glory days, would you want the same job now that the climate has changed so, so dramatically?
I don't think I'd be able to do it now in the same way. Because now there's so many more holes on what people can and can't do.
Yes.
There are lawyers crawling up every programme.
Yeah.
Economists.
Yes.
Making sure you don't waste money and so on and so
forth.
But at the same time, I think you could go out there and spread the word and, by example, show what can be done in a more ambitious and risky way than is currently happening. It's a bit quiet at the moment.
Yes.
Arts on television.
Yeah.
We had a wonderful firebrand called Tony Palmer, who just loved causing trouble in the best possible sense. And there aren't too many troublemakers in the television
Very true. I'm a big fan of BBC Four. I think BBC Four is a great channel, and Sky Arts is pretty good too. But I think they're getting rid of BBC Four. I was reading the other day.
Well, they're not getting rid of it so much as turning it into an archive channel.
Oh yes, that's what it was.
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
Well, I'm all in a sense. I'm pleased if they're going to take the archive and go through it methodically and really reveal all the riches that have buried deep down.
If they've still got them, of course.
Yes, that's right. They did, as we were saying, cannibalize a lot of programs by just turning the tapes back into raw material again, which is a great pity. It's expensive business keeping programs.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm sympathetic with them.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to spend some time with you today, if only on the telephone, Humphrey Burton. Your book is called In My Own Time. I'm glad you managed to get it written in the COVID pandemic. Thank you for doing that for us. It's got some great stories in it. Lovely to talk to you and bring it to life today. You take care of yourself, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Bill, and please say hello to my daughter Helena if you see her.
We will indeed, absolutely. You take care.
She's enjoying your countryside and
the
climate
warmth,
above all.
And
she
the warmth.
Swimming every day. I can't believe it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's what it's all about here. Thank you, Sir Humphrey. Appreciate you talking to us. You take care.
Bye, everybody.
All the best. Bye-bye.